understanding the challenge of Islam. The world has been changed dramatically since September the 11th, 2001, and the terrorist attacks on the United States, or if you're in Kenya in 1998 with the bombing of the US embassy there. These terrorist attacks have deeply ingrained themselves in people's minds, and more people are having a look at Islam and wanting to understand it. It is no accident that the most vicious terrorism originates from the least evangelized area of the world. The Muslim Middle East represents the most complex political challenge and potentially an enormous military threat to the free world. The Muslim nations are also the greatest missionary challenge to the Christian church. Muslim states are the most severe persecutors of Christians worldwide. And radical Muslim extremists are the most vicious terrorists, hijackers, kidnappers, suicide bombers, and assassins. The failure of the Christian church to fulfill the Great Commission in the Middle East continues to have far-reaching and disastrous consequences. Islam is a challenge that we cannot ignore. Yet very few Christians understand Islam or know how to respond to it. The primary suspect for the multiple coordinated terrorist attacks in the United States, Osama bin Laden, aside from his extensive business and terrorist connections, has also been a major sponsor of Islamic missionary activity. Bin Laden has been a financial contributor to the Islamic Propagation Center International, based in Durban. I visited the ICPI on numerous occasions and debated these Muslim extremists in the biggest mosque in the Southern Hemisphere, which is in Durban. The ICPI credited bin Laden with personally financing the translation of the Quran into Zulu. He has been known to make donations of up to £1 million at a time to the Islamic Propagation Center International. Clearly, bin Laden is a radical Islamicist with a broad strategy and with a world vision. His hatred for America is apparently more religiously motivated than political. Although many would see America as a secular country with a large number of Christians, to radical Islamicists like bin Laden, America is the largest and strongest Christian nation on earth and the primary supporter of Christian missions worldwide. By striking at the financial heart of America, one of his aims could have been to cause a drop in the support for Christian missions, even as he helps finance a massive continent-wide Islamic offensive to turn Africa into a Muslim continent. The multinational Al-Qaeda organization set up by bin Laden during the time he is based in Sudan seeks the global radicalization of existing Islamic groups and the creation of radical Islamic groups where none existed. Al-Qaeda supports Muslim fighters in Afghanistan, Bosnia, Chechnya, Tajikistan, Somalia, Yemen, and Kosovo. It also trains members of terrorist organizations from the Philippines to Algeria and Eritrea. Al-Qaeda's goal is to unite all Muslims and to establish a government which follows the rule of the caliphs by force, to overthrow nearly all Muslim governments which are corrupt, to drive Western influence from those countries, and eventually to abolish state boundaries. They want a one-world Islamic superstate under the caliphs. Back in October 1995, Muammar Gaddafi hosted a two-week conference in Tripoli in Libya, which was attended by Muslim leaders from 80 countries. At this Muslim conference, leaders gathered together and strategies to transform Africa into an Islamic continent were discussed. Participants openly admitted that their goals were to make Arabic the official language of the continent of Africa and Islam the official religion. One South African member of parliament, Farouk Kashim, declared it will probably be the biggest revolution to sweep Africa. The head of the Islamic Propagation Center at that time announced afterwards that South Africa was high on the agenda of the Islamic offensive. "We are going to turn South Africa into a Muslim state," he said. "We have the money to do it." At the moment, less than 2% of South Africans are Muslims. About 40% of the population of Africa are Muslims. 17 of the 55 countries in Africa are officially Islamic states. Now, this isn't one of my maps. This is their map. They've marked here the places in green where they claim Muslims are a majority. Of course, this is dream world. Muslims are not the majority in Nigeria. They're not the majority in Cameroon. They're not the majority in Central African Republic. They're not the majority in Ethiopia. They sure aren't the majority in Tanzania or the Ivory Coast or Republic of Guinea. Nevertheless, over here, what you've got is you've got the Muslims claiming to have some countries that they haven't got yet, but it still shows you what they want. This is one of their maps. Notice how prominently South Africa is coloured. They want South Africa. What few Westerners understand is that Muslim leaders who call for the overthrow of all governments and the establishment of an Islamic superstate, controlling all aspects of life for every person on earth, they're not necessarily extremists on the fringe of Islam. Jihad, the subjugation and forcible conversion of all people to Islam, and world domination are in fact central pillars of Islam. Jihad is the sixth pillar of Islam. Jihad was so important to Muhammad that he declared it to be the second most important deed in Islam. Allah's apostle was asked, "What is the best deed?" He replied, "To believe in Allah and his apostle." The questioner then asked, "What is the next in goodness?" And he replied, "To participate in jihad, in religious fighting in Allah's cause." Now think of this. Our Lord Jesus said the second greatest command is to love your neighbor as yourself. Muhammad said the second greatest command is to kill your neighbor. Now, of course, most Muslims are neither terrorists nor we trust terrorist sympathizers, although the latter could be debatable. While many Muslims publicly rejoiced over the news of the horrific terrorist attacks on New York and Washington, D.C., we trust that most didn't, at least not openly. We need to be careful not to blame all Muslims for what certain individuals do in the name of Islam. Of course, those peace-loving, law-abiding Muslims are not being consistent with the jihad teachings in the Quran. They are probably more influenced by the Christian ideal of loving a neighbor than the Islamic doctrine of jihad. In fact, Muslims are often allies of Christians in the campaigns against gambling, pornography, homosexuality, abortion, evolutionism, and atheism. Muslims and Christians also agree that God is both the creator and the eternal judge of the whole world and everyone in it. If you're on a university campus, you may have already noticed how Muslims might be your allies in fighting the evolutionists or fighting against abortion, because these guys do have certain common concerns with us. So we have found ourselves on their side, and they've joined us for some of our marches to Parliament. We've had some of our protests, like the Belleville blasphemy battle against the pornographic exhibit in the library there. The Muslims joined us. I've been on Muslim radio where we have worked together on certain common enemies. So it is interesting that Muslims are often our allies in many of our moral and social campaigns. However, it is important for us to recognize the Quranic roots which are quoted by the Muslim terrorists to support their atrocities. If this violent position does not represent mainstream Islam, then Muslim leaders must clearly denounce the literal application of these jihad verses and declare apostate all Muslims who resort to terrorism as murderers destined to an eternity in hell. Why not? And yet they're not doing it. Muslim leaders should make a public announcement. They might make some private, "You know, these people don't really represent Islam." Well, fine, condemn them. We're happy to condemn apostates who claim to be Christians who come out with all kinds of evils. Why can't Muslims condemn these terrorists as murderers destined to eternity in hell? But I have yet to hear any prominent Muslims doing so. The Quran teaches that Muslims are superior to all others. "Ye Muslims are the best of peoples evolved for mankind." Muslims are forbidden to befriend Jews and Christians. "O ye who believe, take not the Jews and Christians for your friends and protectors. They are but friends and protectors to one another. And he amongst you that turns to them for friendship is one of them." Islam instructs its adherents to fight until all their opponents submit. Christians and Jews may be spared if they pay jizya, a tribute tax, a penalty tax, with willing submission. Surah 9, "Fight those who believe not in God nor the last day, nor acknowledge the religion of truth, even if they are the people of the book." That's us, Christians. "Until they pay jizya, tribute taxes, with willing submission and feel themselves subdued," or feel themselves humiliated, as some translations put it. "Fight and slay the pagans wherever you find them and seize them," enslave them, beleaguer them, "lie in wait and ambush for them in every stratagem or deception of war." That's Surah 9:5. "Therefore, when you meet the unbelievers in fight, smite at their necks at length. When you have thoroughly subdued them, bind a bond firmly on them. Thereafter, it is the time for either generosity or ransom until the war lays down its burdens. Thus are ye commanded. For those who resist Islam, execution or mutilation is decreed. The punishment of those who wage war against Allah and his apostle and strive with might and main for mischief throughout the land is execution or crucifixion or the cutting off of hands and feet from opposite sides or exile from the land." Surah 5:36. Now, all of these texts appear to be contradicted by Surah 2, verse 256, which states, let there be no compulsion in religion. But there seems to be a clear break between the early Muhammad and the later Muhammad. The early Muhammad was married to just one person, one wife, Khadija. He courageously spoke out against idolatry and polytheism in Mecca and encouraged friendship with the Christians. In fact, the early Muhammad ordered his people to pray towards Jerusalem five times a day. In fact, the original Quranic instructions were that they prayed towards Jerusalem. But then there became another Muhammad. The later Muhammad, after the death of his first wife and his flight to Medina, he accumulated at least 14 more wives, including the 6-year-old Aisha, whom he consummated the marriage at age 9. He started raiding caravans. He massacred 200 Jews for failing to acknowledge him as the prophet. Literally killed them in front of their wives and children and sold their wives and children as slaves. In fact, he took one of them as a concubine, one of the widows, whose husband he had just murdered. And this just because they failed to acknowledge him as the prophet. And he started to propagate jihad. In a sense, there's two Muhammads and two Qurans. The early pre-Medina surahs demonstrate tolerance and respect for the Christians, whereas the later surahs unleashed jihad. And so, yes, you can quote some parts of the Quran that sound quite friendly towards Christians. Dispute not with the people of the book. Go to the people of the book. Learn from them. And then there's others. You know, you are not to be a friend of the people of the book. So you've got contradictions within the Quran like that. You've got to understand who wrote what first and last. In the Mishkat, which is part of the Hadith, the rewards for participation in jihad are spelled out. The Messenger of Allah, that's Muhammad, said to whichever village you go, it's 1/5 for Allah and his messenger and the remainder is for you. In other words, you give me 20% of the loot and you can keep the other 80%. This is the deal as far as warfare goes. The Mishkat says the soldiers of Islam fought tooth and nail. They would get paradise in the case of death in a holy war and booties or loot in the case of conquest. Jihad is therefore the best source of all acquisitions. Jihad is one of the chief meritorious acts in the eyes of Islam. It is the best source of earnings. Well, sure, you don't have to work for it. This, by the way, is the Sudan flag. These are Sudanese mujahideen. This is the best method for earning, both spiritual and temporal. If victory is won, there's enormous booty and conquest of a country, which cannot be equal to any other source or earning. If there is defeat to death, there is everlasting paradise and a great spiritual benefit. This sort of jihad is conditional upon pure motive. That is, for the establishing of the kingdom of Allah on earth. In the Hadith, Muhammad is quoted as decreeing that Muslims may not be punished for killing a non-Muslim. No Muslim should be killed for killing a kafir, or an infidel. Here in Saudi Arabia, a woman is about to be beheaded. Those who die in holy war are guaranteed to go into heaven. The person who participates in jihad and Allah's cause, and nothing compels him to do so except belief in Allah and his apostle, will be recompensed by Allah, either with a reward or booty, loot, if he survives, or he'll be admitted to paradise if he is killed. So the one way that a Muslim can be absolutely sure of going to heaven is if he dies in jihad killing the infidel. I've debated some of the finest Muslims in apologetics in the world, like Ahmed Idat, in Durban, in the mosque, before the TV cameras even. And I've asked Ahmed Idat, I mean, this is the guy who founded the Islamic Propagation Center, the one who's written so many hundreds of books with millions of copies printed worldwide, ran a several-hundred-million-dollar operation, the Islamic Propagation Center International, the guy who's known as the number one Islamic debater worldwide, debated Jimmy Swaggart, Josh McDowell, all those guys. And I've asked Ahmed Idat, how can you know for sure that your sins are forgiven? And he shrugged his shoulders and raised his arms three times, with his mouth open but saying nothing. I asked, how can you know for sure that you are going to heaven? And again, his arms and his shoulders were raised, upraised palms, mouth open. He had nothing to say. The most eloquent writer and spokesman of Islam, their number one apologist and debater, before the cameras, in Durban, could not answer a straightforward question. How can you know for sure that you're going to heaven when you die? He's not being totally honest, though. Because according to Quran, there's one way you can know for sure that you're going to go to paradise, according to Islam. If you die killing the infidel, then you go to paradise. Many assume that the concept of jihad or holy war is an aberration, not truly representative of Islam. Some leaders have stated, like Bill Clinton, that Islam teaches a God of love just like Christianity and Judaism, and no religion condones violence or terrorism. Bill Clinton said that after terrorist attacks on the U.S., such U.S. embassies in 1998. Unfortunately, that's just not true. Bill Clinton's either ill-informed or he wasn't being honest. Islam is no ordinary religion. Most religions don't condone violence or terrorism, but Islam does. They do not teach a God of love, just like Christianity, Judaism. There are 99 names for Allah in the Quran, but Father is not one of them. Love isn't either, by the way. Their concept of God is different. There is a certain amount of overlap between Islam and Christianity, and on occasions we can be allies on limited goals. But you cannot say the Allah of the Quran is the same as the God of the Bible. The message of the Quran is not the same as the message of the Bible. Proverbs 14, verse 12 says, "There is a way that seems right unto a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death." Islam divides the whole world into two sectors, Dar al-Islam, the house of Islam, and Dar al-Harab, the house of war. The only countries considered to be at peace are those countries where Islamic law, the Sharia, is enforced. All other countries as part of Dar al-Harab, the house of war, are legitimate military targets. It is significant that the calendar of Islam does not begin with the birth of Muhammad, nor with the onset of his revelations, nor the assembling of the first Muslim community, nor the flight of Muslim refugees to Abyssinia. The 12 years of persecution in Mecca were not considered the start of a new religion. The Muslim calendar only begins when Islam became a political state under the Sharia in Medina. Islam in Arabic means submission, surrender, or subjugation. A Muslim is one who submits. The Arabic word for peace is salam, so the greeting is salam alaikum, peace be upon you. Islam is the active form of salam. So what they're doing is Islam is actually a peacemaking force. Muslims see themselves as a peacemaking force, and they are to use argument, intrigue, commerce, threats, terrorism, warfare, and any other means possible in order to secure Islam as the only true religion worldwide. Surah 8, verse 39, "And fight them on until there is no more tumult or oppression. There prevails justice and faith in Allah altogether and everywhere." Now, in the light of these teachings, it should be no surprise to learn that since 1948, the 21 Arab countries have suffered 30 wars, 63 successful revolutions, at least 75 unsuccessful revolutions, and 36 heads of state were assassinated. In the Arab world, revolutions and assassinations have been the most prevalent means of political expression, the main way of attaining power. It's their term limitation. Name a Muslim democracy in the Middle East. One out of every three barrels of oil sold by the Middle East has gone to pay for weapons. Now, it may be hard for Christians to understand the concept of such a militant religion, but the primary aim of Islam is not spiritual, but political. Now, one exception to this could be the Sufis, mystical Muslims, who reinterpret the jihad passages to apply to a spiritual fight against spiritual sin. However, not even that is watertight, because the Mahdi, who raised the revolution against the British and Egyptians in Sudan back in the 1880s, and who finally, under whose forces General Charles Gordon was beheaded, and who reinstituted slavery, which General Gordon had abolished, and so on, the Mahdi was Sufi, and his movement, which, when it took Khartoum, slaughtered everybody. Everybody. By the way, you will hear all kinds of guilt-manipulative garbage from people who themselves might be guilt-manipulated and ill-informed in history, too, and most Christians don't know how to respond. The amount of imaginative, detailed descriptions that people have given of how the Crusaders killed all the Muslims and all the Jews in Jerusalem when they took it over in 1099, and that the Crusaders slaughtered the Jews, and they even describe how the Crusaders slaughtered the Jews in the mosque, in the synagogues in Jerusalem. Well, that's very imaginative. But there were no Jews in Jerusalem when the Crusaders took it, because the Muslims had expelled every Jew, every Christian out of Jerusalem. There were no Jews in Jerusalem, and there were no Christians in Jerusalem. The Muslims took it over, they expelled them all out, they poisoned the wells for miles and miles around, they chopped down all the trees, they made sure there was not even any shade for the Crusaders that were coming to attack Jerusalem. They deforested the area, they poisoned the wells, they shipped out into this wilderness of scorched earth the Jews and Christians out of Jerusalem in preparation for the siege. And so this imaginative atrocity that Christians are meant to have committed in Jerusalem at the First Crusade is completely fabricated. It's false. However, they did slaughter all the Muslim defenders in Jerusalem. They gave them the chance to surrender, and when they didn't, when these men responded with blasphemous and perverse pornographic type of activities, which I will not describe here, the Crusaders saw it as their duty to cleanse the city of these infidels who had desecrated the holy places, who dishonored the Lord by all kinds of disgusting things that they were doing. I mean, they were literally urinating on crucifixes and pictures of Mary on the walls and the sites of the Crusaders. No wonder the Crusaders slaughtered everybody in Jerusalem when they took over. But there were no Jews there because they'd been expelled by the Muslims. You will hear this fictitious story about the Crusaders wiping out Jews in Jerusalem over and over. What they don't tell you about is the Muslims, the Sufis, that's the pacifist type of spiritual Muslims, killed everybody in the whole of Khartoum in 1885. That's not that long ago. They killed everybody, men, women and children, Muslims and anyone else. Killed them all, not just Egyptians and Europeans. They killed Sudanese too. Slaughtered the whole lot. When they took over Constantinople, the Muslims killed everybody, men, women, children, including in the church. They killed from the patriarch, the women, children gathered in San Sophie, the great cathedral there in Constantinople. With the fall of Constantinople, they killed the people in the churches. They slaughtered them all. The Muslims have slaughtered town after town, and yet you don't hear about that in history. They will continue about the Crusaders and Jerusalem in 1099 and ignore the Muslim practices elsewhere. But my main point here is the Sufis are not exactly pacifists. They killed everybody in the capital city of Khartoum when they conquered it in 1885. The ultimate purpose of Islam is the establishment by force of a worldwide Islamic state where Sharia law is enforced on all. To achieve this goal is the goal of jihad. Islamic scholars identify a multitude of forms that jihad can take. Number one, there is the jihad of words using oratory in a war of nerves to inspire the own side and to undermine the morale of the enemy. You must understand, when Saddam Hussein was speaking about the mother of all battles and the mother of all defeats and so on Americans and threatening George Bush, well, that's part of war of nerves. That's also part of Sharia. That's also part of jihad. Then there's the jihad of deception to confuse the enemy. It's perfectly acceptable to lie in Islam. There is no requirement to tell the truth. You certainly don't need to tell the truth to Christians and Jews and non-Muslims. There is no prohibition on deceit and deception. In fact, it is praised and it is elevated as a form of jihad. Of course, there's the jihad of the sword to kill the enemy, to loot his possessions and to take hostages for ransom. Kidnapping people, holding them for ransom is standard Islamic practice all the way back to Muhammad. There is the jihad of taxation on non-Muslims and financial reward to provide incentives for converts to Islam. There is the jihad of Sharia law, which degrades non-Muslims to a lower status, denying them equal access to the law because their testimony is not valid against a Muslim. Here you've got a picture by somebody who was an eyewitness in Khartoum in January 1885, after General Gordon had been killed and beheaded, and as they started to slaughter the whole population, they systematically, cold-bloodedly hung, beheaded, killed the people of the town. They slaughtered them by the tens of thousands. There's the jihad of polygamy, which is designed to give Muslims a disproportionate numerical advantage by having up to four wives at a time. They want to beat us in many ways, including by having more children. And there is the jihad of the spirits. Even after they die, Muslims are meant to fight for Muhammad. I don't know if they come back as ghosts to haunt us. Inevitably, when you deal with a contemporary problem of Islamic jihad, somebody will bring up the historical issues of the Crusades. Of course, the word crusade does not appear in the Bible anywhere, nor is it commanded in Scripture. However, jihad is commanded in the Quran, and it is practiced by numerous Muslim groups and governments to today. To put the Crusades in a proper context, one needs to study the rapid expansion of Islam by the sword across North Africa, into Spain, throughout Asia Minor, into the Balkans. The Islamic jihad of the 7th to the 10th centuries wiped out more than half of the church worldwide. Prior to this, Christianity was the predominant religion of North Africa and of the Middle East. The Crusades of the Middle Ages were a reaction to the Islamic invasion of the Holy Lands. Those places where our Lord was born, where he lived, where he ministered, where he was crucified, where he was raised from the dead. And so the Crusades were a reaction to the Islamic invasion of the Holy Lands and a reaction to centuries of Islamic jihad. The Saracens, as the Muslim invaders were called, had desecrated Christian places of worship. They were severely persecuting Christians. Pilgrims were being prevented from visiting those sites sacred to their faith. To this day, many Muslims continue the holy war against Christians, for example, in the Sudan. Here's a pastor and his deacon standing in the ashes of their church that had been destroyed by MiG-23 fighter bomber jets. Imagine using supersonic jet fighters to bomb wooden and thatched church structures in the 21st century. That is happening. Millions of Christians have been slaughtered through the centuries by Islamic militants, such as the 1.5 million Armenian Christians murdered in Turkey in 1915. They put them in churches and they burned them by the thousands. Even in the cathedral in Urfa, 3,000 Christians burned to death there. Christian women depicted here being crucified by the hundreds in Turkey in 1915. Others have sought to justify the Islamic practice of jihad because the Muslims were victims of colonialism. I've heard this at Kikawi, the Global Consultation World Evangelism, in no less the missions executives section of this, where a top missions leader, and I will not embarrass him by naming him, claimed that the Muslims are involved in jihad because they've been victims of colonialism. This is a bizarre argument, because Muslim Arabs have been the most pervasive colonialists in history. Within the first century after Muhammad's death, the tribes of Arabia under the caliphs had conquered Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, Algeria, Morocco, Spain, Portugal, Persia, parts of Byzantium, and even parts of France. The Muslim conquerors then forced Arabic as the official medium of communication throughout North Africa and the Middle East. Only Turkey and Persia resisted this policy of Arabization with any success. Over 3,200 churches were destroyed or converted into mosques during the first century of Islamic Jihad alone. The Muslim argument that jihad was only waged in self-defense is therefore unconvincing. What were Arabians defending in Spain? Let me take you back here. Here is Arabia on the map. There is Spain. My goodness, we've got the Red Sea, we've got the Mediterranean, we've got a whole continent between Arabia and Spain. What on earth were Saudi Arabians defending in Spain, Portugal, or France? This is a pathetic argument. I've had a debate with a Muslim imam in the mosque in Isiolwini, up in Swaziland, and when he is claiming that jihad has only been waged in self-defense, I said to him, what were Saudi Arabians defending in Spain? And he turned and he looked at me and he said, I like your style. Never answered the question and went on. They don't answer that. The Christian blacks in southern Sudan and the Nuba Mountains describe their conflict as a war of decolonization against the Arab North. Now, just because the Arab North is directly adjacent to, geographically, southern Sudan, doesn't make it any less colonialism. In 1956, in the first year of independence for Sudan from Britain, of the 800 officials in southern Sudan, only 4 were black Africans. The other 796 were Arabs. I mean, is that colonialism or what? Where everyone running the south, the population is entirely black Africans, and yet all of the people over them and run them, from the governors down to the police chiefs and the commissioners and the town councillors and district commissioners, they're all Arabs. That's colonialism. The Arabs just came in, they took over all the shops, they made Friday the official day of rest in the south, they made Sunday a day for school and for the market, and this isn't a Christian south. The Arabs just, this is right back 1956. No wonder the war started. Christians had enough of it. It is colonialism. The Arabs have colonialized in Sudan as they have in every other part. After the fall of the Roman Empire in the 5th century, the practice of slavery declined throughout Europe. But the spread of Islam in the 7th century led to a great revival of the institution of slavery, especially in Africa. Great merchant camel caravans traveled beyond the Sahara to the vast savannah, which the Arabs called the Sudan. Sudan means the land of the black people. Makes you wonder why they call it an Arab country now. These caravans brought back long lines of black slaves to the Arab households and palaces in the Mediterranean. Male household servants were routinely castrated. Most babies born to black servants and harems were drowned or killed at birth to maintain Arab numerical superiority. One Arab writer in the 9th century justified this flourishing trade, saying, the kings of the blacks sell their own people without justification or in consequence of war. The horrors of the slave trade, the Islamic slave trade, were well documented by explorers like David Livingstone, Samuel Baker, the British Anti-Slavery Commission in East Africa, Sir John Kirk. These men set thousands of slaves free. The Arab slave market in Zanzibar sold an average of 200 to 300 slaves every single day, even as late as the 1870s when the British invaded and put an end to it. At one time, 7 out of every 8 black people in Sudan were slaves. The British governor, General Charles Gordon, crushed the slave trade in Sudan, losing his life and being beheaded in the process. In recent years, slavery has resurfaced in Sudan under the National Islamic Front government. Isaiah 59 describes it. Their works are works of iniquity, and the acts of violence is in their hands. Their feet run to evil, and they make haste to shed innocent blood. Wasting and destruction are in their paths. After the bombing attacks on the United States embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam in August 1998, which left over 260 dead and 5,000 injured. The United States bombed targets in Sudan and Afghanistan, claiming that those governments supported bin Laden's terrorist network. The State Department's April 2001 overview of state-sponsored terrorism reported that Sudan continued to be used as a safe haven by members of various groups, including associates of Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda, Egyptian Islamic Jihad, and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and Hamas. It was in Sudan that bin Laden laid the framework for his Al-Qaeda terrorist network, which has branches around the world, and thousands of young warriors willing to die in their jihad against the United States and the allies. The Sudanese regime actually gave birth to bin Laden, the terrorist. The terrorist inclinations of the National Islamic Front governor of Sudan, who hosted bin Laden, is attested to by the savage way in which they have continued to wage war against the Christian blacks of southern Sudan. Here's a picture of a service where I was preaching on the Sunday morning in Sudan, where we were bombed on the Sunday morning during the church service. Amnesty International has recorded horrific atrocities. Male villagers killed in mass executions. Women and children nailed to trees with iron spikes. Children's throats slit. Male prisoners having nails hammered into their foreheads. People being crushed under tanks, strafed by helicopter gunships. That's Amnesty International's report on human rights abuses in Sudan. Do you know that more Christians died in Nigeria at the hands of Muslim terrorists on September 11, 2001, than in New York? Fresh violence erupted in Nigeria as Muslim youth ran onto the streets. As they heard of the successful terrorist attacks against America and the World Trade Center coming down, they ran to the streets out of the mosque screaming, Allah Akbar! And they celebrate the news by hacking people to death. The first person to die was a pregnant woman and her baby. Many hundreds of churches were destroyed and thousands of Christians killed by Muslim militants in northern Nigeria during that week. It was a massive attack. And it was coordinated, it was systematic, it was across the whole northern Nigeria. They were waiting for something. And when the terrorist attacks happened in America, they spread out because they knew that all news attention would be on New York. They could get away with anything in Nigeria at that time. In the Philippines and Indonesia, Christians continued to be beheaded, churches destroyed by Muslim terrorists. In Sudan, churches, hospitals, schools, and mission stations have been subjected to repeated aerial bombardments by the National Islamic Front government of Sudan. We've got paperweights in our office and in our cabinets as reminders of shrapnel that's landed close to us during bombing and artillery attacks by the Muslims. There's a big piece of a bomb, a piece of shrapnel that was dropped by a MiG-23 fighter bomber on our mission base in Sudan, which is just outside the front door of our mission in Rondebosch to remind us of what a peaceful, tolerant religion Islam is. Our mission base in Sudan was bombed 10 times, about 120 bombs dropped on our mission base, school, clinic, and community. So, what should our response be to the recent terrorist attacks and ongoing jihad against so many Christians worldwide? Firstly, we need to recognize that this terrorism and this anti-Christian persecution is originating in the least evangelized area of the world, the Middle East. The birthplace of the church is now the most needy mission field on earth. If we truly want to uproot the support bases of such terrorism and implode the regimes that persecute Christians, we need to get really serious about the Great Commission. This will mean recognizing that we are already in a spiritual world war. And the only reason why the devil is so often winning is because the church is so seldom fighting. Submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. If we find the devil's not fleeing from us, either we're not submitting to God or we're not resisting the devil. We must not just retreat into our barracks to sing battle songs. We must attack strongholds. We must not only talk about our spiritual weapons, we must use them. We must not only praise our commanding officer, we must obey him. I think any commanding officer would prefer to have obedience than people shouting his praises and giving three cheers and all that. And the best form of defense is attack. Now, civil governments have a ministry of justice. Under God, they have a duty to protect their citizens by bearing the sword, being an agent of wrath to bring punishment on the wronger. That's the job of the government. Our duty in the Christian church is to be a ministry of grace. The state is to be a ministry of justice, we to be a ministry of grace. We are to be a house of prayer for all nations, preaching repentance and forgiveness of sins to all nations, making disciples of all nations and teaching obedience to all things that the Lord has commanded. We have a unique opportunity at this time of crisis, during these wars against terrorism, to proclaim the gospel of Christ to Muslims all over the world. Instead of reacting in anger or malice, which is pretty unconstructive, let's seek God's grace to reach out to Muslim neighbors in Christian love. This is the time when we can openly and politely discuss the differences between the gospel and the example of Christ and the teachings and the actions of Muhammad. And if we do it in a polite, calm way, we can share personal testimony and challenge Muslims to consider the claims of Christ. We can obtain, give Christian literature or Bibles to Muslims in our neighborhoods. Have a chance on the streets tomorrow when we have our outreach to target Muslims. We've got some specific Muslim literature too, if you want to do that. And we should invest in Christian radio programs specifically designed to reach Muslims. Sat7 is a satellite TV evangelistic program based in Cyprus, which broadcasts to the whole Muslim world by satellite TV in Arabic. And do you know, when I first heard, I said, well, how many Muslims have access to satellite dish and satellite TV? So about 50 million. I had no idea. Even Bedouins in the middle of the desert with their tents somehow have some satellite dish up there, and they're having all kinds of internet requests for Bibles, and the Jesus film is being proclaimed, and people are responding throughout the Muslim. There's a lot of secret believers in the Muslim world because internet and the satellite ministries and the radio ministries are reaching Muslims, and God is at work in the Muslim Middle East. There's something going on. We should wholeheartedly support missionary work in Muslim countries. If bin Laden can invest in translating the Quran into African language and finance massive print runs of Islamic literature, even in Durban, how much more should we as Christians invest in Bible translations and Christian literature? By God's grace, Frontline Fellowship has already distributed over 250,000 Bibles and Christian books, much of it in Arabic, throughout southern Sudan and Nub Mountains, and we must do much more in future. Psalm 72 has this great prophecy. The desert tribes will bow down to him, and his enemies will lick the dust. All kings will bow down to him, and all nations will serve him. The Arabs will bow down to Christ. The Muslims will lick the dust. They will all, one day, be bowing down and worshipping the Lord Jesus Christ. It will happen. There's no power on earth that can stop it. Jesus Christ, the King of kings and Lord of lords, he is a conqueror. The earth will be as full of the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the seas are full of water. We must rediscover the imprecatory prayers. We must be praying the Psalms. God will crush the heads of his enemies, of all those who go on in their sins. The Psalms are the prayer book of the Bible. I recommend that you pray through at least one psalm a day. Make the Psalms a daily prayer of your heart. It will revive your prayer life. And it's a lot of prayers in the Psalms against God's enemies. Pray the Psalms. I've written about my research in a Muslim country in Sudan, the largest country in Africa, the longest war that has been raging, although at this moment they're heading towards peace. And Faith Undefined Sudan has got 230 pages, 140 pictures, 7 maps. It's got the history, it's got the contemporary situation, the courage of the Christians, the cruelty of the Muslims, the modern slave trade, the atrocities. And you can also use the Sudan, the Hidden Holocaust, and terrorism persecution videos to alert people in university campuses to what a threat Islam is and the incredible courage of the Christians, the tenacious Christians, our beleaguered brethren who have been standing firm, an island of Christianity in the Sea of Islam, or our brothers in Nigeria and what they're suffering over there. We've also got a Muslim Evangelism Workshop manual and tape series on how to evangelize Muslims too. Of course, if you're going to be involved in trying to reach Muslims, expect people to try and shoot you in the back, not just physically, but I'm talking about spiritually here. There will be those who will try to assassinate the characters of those who go after the real enemies of the gospel. Much of these materials, including this message, is available on our website. You'll also find in the Muslim Evangelism Manual this message as well, uprooting terrorism or understanding the challenge of Islam.